Now it's time for our weekly chat with Labor MP Andrew Little.
This week with Justice Minister Andrew Little, I asked him about current progress on the negotiations with the Green Party, his priorities for treaty settlement over the next 3 years if he retains the portfolio, and the recent recruitment drive from the country's intelligence agencies. But I began by asking the minister what will happen next for the cannabis and euthanasia bills if their respective referendums, which we will know about their preliminary results by 2 p.m. tomorrow, are passed. I might just start this week by talking about the preliminary results of the referendums that will be announced tomorrow. So what's next for the bills if they are passed, the referendums?
Well, the End of Life Choice Act has already been passed through Parliament, so it's gone through all the stages, and the referendum was really a condition for the legislation to enter into force. So for the End of Life Choice to come into force, all it required was a yes vote at a referendum. So we'll know tomorrow whether or not that legislation will come into force. If it does so, it'll be 12 months from the date of the final return of the writs, which will be the final return of the writs, the 6th of November 2020, which means that if there is a yes vote on end-of-life choice, it'll come into force on the 6th of November 2021. And the cannabis referendum, that is draft legislation, so we put that together to indicate what legislation would look like for the control of cannabis in the community. So if there is a yes vote, that legislation has to go through the full parliamentary process. So a bill introduced goes to a select committee, public submissions, debates in Parliament. That can take anywhere between 6 and 9 months. And then if the legislation is passed, then there's then a time required to put together the machinery of government to, you know, to make the bill work. So it could, if there is a yes vote on cannabis, it could be 12 to 18 months, possibly 2 years, for the law to come into effect. Of course, if there's a no vote on either of them, then, you know, nothing changes.
Kind of want to focus on the cannabis referendum. Mm. Is the bill going to play in any part in Labor's negotiation with the Greens?
I'm not involved in those negotiations. I'm not aware of that. I mean, actually, the whole idea of having a referendum came out of the confidence and supply agreement with the Greens last time. And I think the ship of cannabis legalisation and control set sail in the last term of government. It really comes down to now what the referendum shows. You know, are people prepared to go down that path? If there is a yes vote, then the draft legislation as it is, there might be some tweaks, but pretty much the draft legislation as it was presented to the public for the purposes of the referendum will be introduced to Parliament, and it'll be then for Parliament through its processes to make changes, address some of the questions that arose during the debate about cannabis control. But I'm not aware of it being any further conditions being attached to negotiations with the Greens at the moment.
Speaking of the negotiations, I know you aren't really a big part of this, but any idea how progress is going?
Well, I understand progress is being made, and I think the expectation is to have the negotiations wrapped up by the end of this week, and so that the respective decisions or decision-making processes for each party can take place next week. And as I understand it, that is all on track for that to happen.
You said you want to keep the treaty negotiations portfolio for the next 3 years, and previously the government has a target of clearing all historic treaty claims by the end of this year, and now the end of 2020 is coming nearby. How is that going?
Yeah, I think we revised that. That 2020 deadline was yet another deadline imposed by successive governments that hasn't been achieved, and look, no way of it being achieved at the moment. There's roughly 40-odd agreements yet to be achieved. We sort of pushed it out to 2024, 2025. I indicated that the priority would be, in fact should be, concluding agreement with Ngāpuhi. That is going to take a while to do that. But yeah, look, whoever the minister is, once the decisions are made on portfolio allocation, this remains a very important area. It's, you know, it does a huge amount for iwi who reach agreement with the government over breaches of the treaty. It can make a huge difference to those iwi, and it'd be very empowering. So we want to continue to give priority to that. But I think the largest iwi, Ngāpuhi, is, you know, we've trying to find a formula to get negotiations underway. I think we're sort of starting to make progress now, and I think it's important that that continues.
The Crown wants to have a single settlement for the entire iwi instead of having separate settlements with hapu. And mostly hapu wants the Crown to deal with them directly instead of through the iwi. Why does the Crown wants to have a single settlement instead of interacting with the hapu independently?
The way it's shaping up is, we said for Ngapu, look, you work out a structure for negotiations, because previously there had been an arrangement where there was sort of nominated areas and groupings, and that clearly wasn't going to work. I think most hapu realise that actually it does make sense for them to work in groups, because the nature of Ngapu hapu is that they cover, compared to many other iwi, a reasonably confined space with 110 hapu in it. And actually, they have a lot of common interests and a lot of overlapping interests. So actually, a fair few groupings are coming together at the moment. And the Crown has indicated we will structure negotiations on that sort of basis. And people can reach agreement on cultural redress and those sorts of things. When it comes to compensation or quantum for things like suppression of the language, poor economic and social policies that have caused deprivation, that has affected, all hapu and all ngapu right across the board. And it's difficult to see how you would break that up into what does it mean for this particular hapu compared to that particular hapu. And I have simply raised that as a matter of negotiation, we should think about how sensible it is to try and divvy up that part of the quantum that would be, that the Crown ought to be liable for when it comes to redress for the treaty breaches. In the end, it's a matter for negotiation, but we've got to get those negotiations underway, and that's what we're trying to do at the moment.
Moving on to Ihu Matau. Now, it's almost a year since this first happened. Is there a deal in sight?
Look, a lot of work has gone into trying to reconcile the interests of the various parties there. I understand that everybody was reasonably close to agreement. There was a framework that had been agreed to and people were comfortable with. The Prime Minister has committed personally a lot of time and energy to it. Ministers like Willie Jackson were very integrally involved in it. But we just couldn't get it over the line at the Cabinet table. That may well change now with the government formed the way that it is. And I expect you will see a response on that or some action on that reasonably early in the life of the new government once things are settled down and things are put in place.
The Māori Party said way back early in this year, any deal on Ihu Matau should spur an overhaul of the unfair treaty settlement process and open up millions of hectares of confiscated land to negotiation. As the current treaty negotiations minister, what do you think of this?
Well, I think it defies anything that's ever been in place before. It defies the law that's on the statute books. It defies the basis on which 50-odd iwi have entered into agreements with the Crown. It's the sort of thing that you say to get attention to yourself, but I think the Māori Party would have absolutely no way of putting that into effect and don't expect it to be put into effect.
Going on to my final topic for this week. Now, recently the SIS in the GCSB has opened a campaign drive to get more people to fill its vacancies, and it included a very wide social media campaign, and I saw your social media handles have also shared this piece of information. So why would the SIS in GCSB have a very public camp recruitment drive?
I think, look, the reality is they are organisations that exist. I think, they may have sort of been under the covers for a long time. The reality is they do exist. They provide a very important function for government and for the security of New Zealand. They are, organisations that are growing in number, so hundreds of employees for across the two of them. And like any organisation, they have to recruit the best talent available. And I don't think there's any harm in actually going and saying, you know, we do exist, we need talented people, and if you're, you know, if this interests you, then let us know. And I think it's, I'm very pleased with the fact that they're embarking on recruitment in this sort of way. I mean, in the past it's been sort of, you know, tap on the shoulder, and it's do you know somebody, and it's all sort of been down on the lowdown. But I think to open it up into a more transparent and competitive process, I think is a good thing. It's a healthy thing in a country like ours.
That was Labour MP Andrew Little. The Wire.